You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 23rd of February to the 1st of March 2017. My name is Chris Parr and I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook and writers Matthew Rice and John Elms coming up in today's podcast. Even as the world has become more and more globalised, the study of modern languages at universities in many countries has been in decline. How are they adapting to the challenges? This is the latest in our in-depth looks at the state of university subjects, and Matthew will take us through what scholars in four countries had to say in this week's cover feature. Karen's presence means that we will have a rundown of this week's THE Books section, and our second feature this week, titled Dons of a Different Kind, sees John Elms speaking to Felia Allam, an ethnographer of the Mafia. It's the latest in our Outer Limits series, in which we speak to scholars who do research outside of the comfort zone. But to kick things off, Matthew, let's come to you, and our cover feature this week is looking at the decline of modern languages, and indeed, how to fix it.
Indeed. I mean, in many countries, certainly most of the English-speaking world, there's been a lot of anxiety expressed about two things. One is the monolingualism of many English-speaking countries, and also, what's obviously related, the fact that comparatively few students want to do modern languages. There have been some well-known departments which have closed. Student numbers have not been looking good, and so on. So this is a very big problem which has been discussed for many years, but I think has not been getting any better. So we were asking academics in Britain, the United States, Australia and Denmark what is happening and what they can do. And I think it remains a fairly sobering picture in many ways, but there are quite a lot of important initiatives which have been done. There have been quite a lot of lobbying of government. There's been a good deal of inventiveness in creating joint degrees, moving beyond sort of traditionally literary studies to embrace other areas of culture, history and so on. And perhaps most enthusiastically, a research agenda which has again moved from beyond the sort of purely literary to areas of great policy and human interest, what monolingualism means within countries, because obviously even so-called English-speaking countries are deeply multilingual, and also research which is in some ways opening up to the public, engaging with the public in ways, and also just the fact that even areas like medicine, international development, even engineering, all these things actually have an important linguistic element. It does matter. I mean, just to take an example, I've heard women describing what it's like to give birth in a foreign language where everyone is talking another language around you. And it is just a very different experience. And these sort of things, linguists can actually add insights and help with important human and policy issues.
In my introduction to the piece, which I shamelessly lifted from the magazine, I mentioned increasing globalisation in recent years and how maybe you might expect languages study and to fare very well. Recently we've seen a little bit of a different political climate, maybe a bit of a lashing out at globalisation and more populism, more nationalism. Did those themes come out in these discussions with these linguistic scholars from across the world?
Yes, well, I think they were all fairly, I think without exception, insofar as they talked about it, pretty dismayed by what has been happening. Trump and Brexit are probably not very good news for people who are committed to internationalism and exchange of cultural ideas and so on. I mean, the American contributor, I'm not sure if he actually included in the article, said bizarrely it hasn't been true that there's less money going into foreign languages during Republican administrations, which you might expect. There obviously is a kind of response, that if in some ways countries are getting more insular, that means some people will want to reach out. It may mean that, it's not true that everyone in the world speaks English. If we want to do a lot of trade deals, for example, Britain wants to do a lot of trade deals with countries other than European countries where there's a high level of English speaking, that we may need more languages. So it's possible that the incentives will push in various different directions, but I think it's safe to say that it's kind of the cultural climate, or the mainstream cultural climate, is perhaps a rather depressing one for most of the linguists I spoke to.
Indeed. Well, you can read that feature from page 32 of this week's magazine. You'll also find it on timeshighereducation.com, of course. Karen, what's in the books this week?
So many books, so little space, so little time. Fortnightly column, new and noteworthy, in which I try to cram five more books into the pages and wax lyrical about them myself. This week, Alain Badiou addresses young people, 80 years old, still down with the kids, and talking about the ladies as well.
Down with the kids, is that
definitely, apparently so. It probably was about 20 years ago when I last met a kid. Ruth Belling's written a fantastic small published book called How to Manage a Research Project, Achieve Your Goals on Time and Within Budget. So anyone who thinks they need a little help will find a lot of great reassurance and dry understatement. And a book on Being Bionic, The World of TV Cyborgs, from Bronwyn Calvert. Also in this week's issue in full reviews, fantastic new book by Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who may well be known to you for her book A Midwife's Tale. She's writing about women in early Mormonism recovering from their diaries and personal accounts, the stories of that other gender. You know, you often think with books that given the time it takes to write one, the time it takes to publish, and the time it takes for me to get it out to be reviewed and published, it's very hard to address things topically. A lot of people would argue that, you know, the monograph just doesn't work in our rapidly moving age. However, I'm always struck by how many books, and our reviewers are as well, seem to be very topical indeed. Fantastic review from Richard Williams of a book called Cities in Time, Temporary Urbanism and the Future of the City by Ali Madanipour. It's about pop-ups and why that has been such a thing in architecture. The beach in Paris, Box Park in Shoreditch, for those of you with teenagers who go to London. Yeah. It is. There's going to be one in Croydon as well.
And
also very topically, an American scholar, Justin Guest, writing about the new minority, white working class politics in an age of immigration and inequality, reviewed by probably the UK's leading peer, I would suppose, writing about working class people in the country, Lisa McKenzie from the LSE. Robert Eaglestone reviews Peter Hay's book, Why? Explaining the Holocaust. And Eaglestone points out how necessary this book's myth-busting is. It's a very straightforward, fact-filled book, calmly and sensibly. The word Trump turns up in my reviews a lot. And our book of the week by Krishna Dronamraju, an extremely eminent geneticist, on the guy who took him on as a doctoral student, his final doctoral student. He's actually not at all an obscure figure, J.B.S. Haldane. Dronamraju was his very final student when he came to India. And since then, when he hasn't been doing things like being president of the Foundation for Genetic Research in Houston, Texas, I would say filial piety, I suppose only if you call your PhD supervisor your Dr. Vader, but Dronamraju has written with great insight on Haldane's life and his work, and this biography is probably his biggest book yet on that noted figure. It's a fantastic review, and the book is clearly really worth reading. A lot went on in Professor Haldane's life.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you, Karen. All of those books, of course, are reviewed online in our books section. Just click the relevant tab, and in the magazine this week too. John Elms, over to you. Our second feature this week is the latest in our Outer Limits series. We speak to scholars who do work that takes them outside of probably most people's comfort zones. In this case, Felia Alam is the ethnographer you've been speaking to about her work with the Mafia.
Indeed, yes. As you say, an ethnographer of the Mafia, particularly the Camorra. Felia Alam is an academic from the University of Bath, a lecturer in Italian history and politics. And she, you know, her interest from in the Mafia sprang from her father, who was also an academic, Percy Alam, at the University of Reading. And he covered a lot of Italian politics in the 50s and 60s, but didn't really cover the Mafia. And she questioned, I suppose, the art of a true academic. When you're young, you question what people do. And she did that, and you know, she started to get more into it, and she did her PhD in on the Kimura, and she's done lots of research recently. And this has all culminated recently with the publication of her book, The Invisible Kimura, Neapolitan Crime Families Across Europe. It's about, essentially, the diaspora of the Kimura clan, which is a Sicilian mafia, which hadn't been covered much before. It's it's not the Sicilian mafia, it is the Neapolitan.
They're the Ndrangheta.
Ndrangheta, absolutely.
Oh, I think this is a blunder, which is you'll pay for this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you are indeed right. Too much has been paid on the Sicilian mafia, not enough on the Neapolitan. Yeah. Look, I'm a victim of my own feature. She's studied the Kimura in depth and has written this book and, you know, investigates the kind of spread of these Camorristi across Europe, and she focuses on many different countries. Obviously, from our perspective, it's interesting to hear what she said about the UK and the Kimura clan, of which there is quite a distinct amount of presence or has been in the past. And Filia in particular looks at the clan, the La Torre clan. Which was a clan from Mondragone, the Mondragone region in the northwest of Naples. one of whom, the sons of the founder of the clan, moved to Scotland in the 1980s. And this, you know,
he drew the short straw.
Well, yes, I mean he was. It's speculated that he left Italy to escape the clutches of the authorities. But Filia also mentions he had a Scottish wife, so he had a reason to move to Scotland as well.
So don't write in, people. Scotland's a perfectly lovely place.
It is a perfectly lovely place. It's just not really as sunny as Naples.
No, quite. Yeah. And just to allay any fears, Filia does mention in the conversation she had with me about mafia that there isn't a gang of mafiosi running around Scotland looking to do the stuff that mafia have been noted to do in popular culture and historically.
Did you mention popular culture in your interview? Is there a sort of mismatch between, you know, the mafia that you might encounter in films and someone who's actually, you know, been there, spoken to them, done that?
Yeah, absolutely. She does mention actually the fact that we have to be careful about, you know, the way the popular culture has in some ways glamorized, you know, she calls it the mixing of trash and glam and crime that certain programs such as Mob Wives or even, you know, beautiful films such as The Godfather, although she doesn't mention that, you know, these wonderful pieces of art that we go, oh, this is such a fantastic film, but it actually, you know, kind of in some ways, you know, paints a romantic picture of the mafia. And, you know, they are real. I mean, the Kimura brought to light really by the works of Roberto Saviano from his book Gomorra, which was published in 2006 and which got made into a film and then a TV program, you know, showing the brutality of some of these mafia groups. And it should be known that they have, you know, they have caused problems in the past. And she, as an academic, it's important to research these things, but also shine a light on it. And, you know, and she mentions the point that it's important for academics to do this. So, you know, academic research is crucial for the long-term struggle to bring down the mafia, as it were.
Was she scared?
She was. She said it was interesting speaking to her, because obviously the first question I asked, I was scared a little bit to speak to her. I was like, what are the repercussions for me, let alone the academic? But she said that the mafia world, particularly the Kimura, moves so fast that the stuff that she's researching now is long gone. It's already passed, and they're moving on to different things. So although she was trepidatious in areas, she was very, you know, reassured, I suppose. Maybe it's not the right word, but, you know, all the people she was interviewing had been moved on from the interest of the mafia. She wasn't putting herself in too much difficulty. Yeah.
Well, a fascinating write-up from page 40 in this week's magazine. And, of course, as I keep saying, do visit timeshighereducation.com to read all the stories we've discussed. If you wish to comment on anything we've spoken about, you can do so on our website below the line. Just leave a comment there. You'll also find us on Twitter and on Facebook and on LinkedIn. Search for Times Higher Education on those platforms. That's all, though, for this week's THE Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.